Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Azar Nafisi, whose latest book is Things I've Been Silent About, Memories, an earlier book, Reading Lolita in Tehran, and a book before that in Farsi on Vladimir Nabokov. Azar Nafisi is a visiting professor at Johns Hopkins University and teaches classes in the relationship of culture and politics. This particular book follows on the heels of another memoir. There's a person you refuse to name, a very good friend of yours in Reading Lolita in Tehran. Yeah. Is he named in the next book?
He's sort of hidden, but not really named, no. I thought that he's enough mad at me for bringing him in at all. So I thought that this time I'll just try to, you know.
That brings up a question which is involved in writing a memoir set in a state that is a religious totalitarian state, in that it's very important to ensure that you protect those people who are still there.
Yes, it is very important, and I believe that in a memoir, the most important thing, of course, you should not play with facts and change them. That is absolutely not part of the game. But what is important is to know that a memoir is also a narrative construct, and a person is going to get hurt, you know, in a physical way or by a repressive state. You have the duty to preserve their identity. Some scenes you obviously remember from your memory. Other people might have different memories.
But you have to kind of disguise stuff because some people are pretty obvious, right?
You disguise them, but you don't disguise the truth. Sometimes you can tell all the facts and not tell the truth.
And sometimes you tell the truth and can disguise
and
the
facts.
And
can disguise the facts. And the important thing is to remain true to the essence of what you're saying.
It's funny that you say that because that's a very common concept that I hear from writers who write fiction. Truth being more important than fact.
Well, for fiction, definitely. And that is why fiction is so fantastic.
Then let me ask you this. Why aren't you writing fiction?
You know as well as I do that, first of all, writing is like love. You fall in and out of love, and you can give hundreds of reasons for it, but still you really would not be able to articulate why. I write memoirs because fiction, I think, is the greatest form of narrative ever. I feel that I cannot just write something and disguise it as fiction. It has to be genuine fiction. Maybe I should get the memoir out of the way.
Are you thinking now in terms of fiction?
I am thinking in terms of another narrative, and I thought that I should give myself some space because I find out that these stories seem to be in you, and you really discover them. So I need to sort of find some space between the two books.
When you're talking about the difference between fiction and nonfiction or memoir and fiction, you know, we talk about fiction as metaphor. Can memoir also be metaphor, do you think?
I think that for memoir, in order to work, for any form of storytelling, in order to work, it has to go beyond itself. I mean, you have to go into the particular moment. That is very important. And to be able to reinvent the experience. But you reinvent the experience, and like reality, there are so many resonances to it. Otherwise, I don't think a memoir works.
In doing my research here, you know, I started by jotting down political ideas, wearing the veil, thought police. There's so much in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I continued to do my work, I began seeing these odd literary connections. For instance, in Reading Lolita in Tehran, there's mention of books like Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah.
And Pride and Prejudice concerns the relationship or lack thereof between public and private spheres, how people interact in Victorian England. And as I was thinking about that, it suddenly came back to me elements of things I've been silent about, because it seems almost as if there's this correlation between the Islamic Republic and Victorian England.
There definitely is, and that is why when we look at things from a very narrow political lens, when we think that we have just invented reality that didn't exist before us, that is where we go wrong. Because I think that what fiction reminds us is that we share the best and the worst. In many ways, present-day Iran is like Victorian England or like Puritanical America. And nobody has a monopoly on any of these, either fundamentalism or freedom.
In her own way, Elizabeth Bennet is ripping off the veil.
She definitely is. When you think of the situation of a woman during her time, when not marrying a man who could support her meant a life of not just bleak financial future, but also being shunned from the society. And she says no. She says no to those norms. And once you imagine something that has not yet existed in reality, it becomes possible.
Which brings us to quotes concerning the nature of the imagination and how the Iranian regime seeks to suppress the imagination.
I think that one of the most dangerous things for any repressive mindset, especially tyrannical regimes, is imagination. What are they going to do with the way we think or feel? I remember when I was doing Reading Lolita in Iran, there was a letter Henry James had written to a friend of his against the violence and brutality of World War I. And he kept saying, feel. Feel all you can. And that is what literature does to you. It awakens your feelings. And it awakens your sense of dignity as a human being, as an individual. And that is the most subversive thing you can do to a repressive mindset.
Let's talk about what else you can do to a repressive mindset, which is write two successive memoirs, both of which discuss the nature of literature. In an interview you gave in 2004 while you were publicizing Reading Lolita in Tehran, you said that you were interested in getting back to the book you were writing on, a book on the topic of loss. Mm-hmm. In that interview, you said, unfortunately, you have to be deprived of something to see its worth. That idea, that book that you were writing, do you think that you stayed on course throughout, or do you think that somehow something else took over?
Would things have been silent about?
Yeah.
I think that it still is about both the idea of loss and absence, because I think literature is always about an absence. You're either retrieving something or imagining something that has not happened. And for me, that absence came to the surface through the loss of my parents, first my mother in 2003 and then my father in 2004. So loss is the silent partner here in this book. I mean, what are you going to do? Every moment is taken away from you. And the only way you can resist death is to write about life.
I kept thinking in terms of loss. There's a very poignant scene in the book where you go back to the Caspian Sea.
Oh, yes.
And the beautiful home that you, or cabin, that you went to and your father had bought was all destroyed.
And that cabin you talk about is my father built it literally with his own hands, and the flowers that he would stop on his way to the Caspian, go into the forest and try to find wild flowers. Time and time again, when things like this happen, I find out how easy it is to lose everything that is closest to you materially. And that was one of the most traumatic experiences.
Azar Nafisi, when you're beginning a memoir, when you're shaping it, how do you know where to begin?
It is, to be honest with you, not the foggiest idea. Because, you know, what happened was that first you become obsessed. I realized that this story I've been writing all my life, I just didn't know it. I was obsessed with my parents, especially with my mother and her lack of approval of me. The first thing that happened when she died was that I became obsessed with the photographs. I would take her photographs and look at them for hours with a magnifying glass, brooding over her and writing about her, and then memories kept leaping up. Of course, I also went back to my diaries. So it started itself, and then I started to cut and paste, to shape.
You grew up in a privileged family. What's the difference between the way you grew up and the way the common Iranian would grow up?
There are certain things that common Iranians share. Like when I talk about Ferdowsi, our epic poet who wrote the Book of Kings, I am not exaggerating when I tell you, you go into the house of every single Iranian and you find a copy of Ferdowsi, a copy of Hafez or Khayyam. poetry is what makes us Iranian, not even geography or the land that has been taken and conquered so many times. So that I think I have in common with Iranians. With my family, it wasn't so much wealth, which somehow, paradoxically, my parents shunned so much that I always felt we are in need of money. I don't know why. But it was culture. And it was a culture that was not just Persian. We read and went to the movies. We didn't differentiate where it came from. So that was different. And also the fact that I went to England and later United States and Switzerland at an early age. And I think that is not something that every Iranian would have had a chance to do.
And in terms of a more like liberal viewpoint toward the world, that as well, you think?
I found that as in Iran, the rise of middle classes brought with it more pluralism and different viewpoints. My parents always felt marginal in the sense of being on the margins of society, never completely feeling at home anywhere. And I think that created a restlessness both in them and in my brother and I, which also bred liberalism because you never felt quite at home in your own home.
From the outside, it strikes me that your mother was viewed by others as a liberal, open, expansive woman, which is not something that you necessarily saw.
Yes, you know, it is so interesting to look at yourself or people close to you through the eyes of strangers because the person they see is completely different. One thing that many people who knew her not intimately praised her for was her outrageous outspokenness. She didn't care if what she said was against her interests. She had to say it. And people admired it. But that translated in our intimate family life or people who were close to her, not just her family, into also an outspokenness that wanted to shape everything that we were, you know, an inflexibility which, if you were a stranger, you would not experience.
Well, she also grew up in the period when women were getting rights. You know, I think of my grandmother who tried to control the family because she couldn't do anything here in the States.
I'm so glad you bring this up because, again, this shows how universal these problems are. I call her an in-between woman. Her best friend, whom in the book I call Aunt Mina, she used to say, oh, another intelligent woman gone to waste. And I was reading Alice Sebold's memoir, Lucky, and she talks about the women of the 50s. And you talk about your grandmother. When people are not fulfilled, when they have more potential than fulfillment, they become very bitter. And my mother was an essentially bitter woman who could not leave her bitterness behind.
And this is even through the period when she became one of the best-known women in all of Iran.
Yes, because I guess satisfaction should come from within. And she basically lacked that. Some women, like Sebald talks about her mother, resort to alcoholism. My mother shunned fun and anything to do with self-fulfillment or self-satisfaction.
Yet at the same time, she had those coffee clutches all the time.
Oh, yes. You know, the best memories are when she had, it was Turkish coffee, and she would let go. And with those women, she would become lovely and the part that we seldom saw. And another was when we would go shopping with her, like shopping for coffee or chocolates or spices in the streets of Tehran. And that same free-heartedness would come to her.
As I read it, and I guess as you were writing it, more and more sympathy came toward your mother to a point where I was thinking, you know, what is Azar, you know, moaning about? This woman isn't that bad.
You're absolutely right. And I guess that is one thing about writing, not just memoirs, but especially memoir. First of all, it saves you from becoming a victim. Because you realize the vulnerabilities of those whom you think are victimize you and you realize your own powers because you realize how frustrated she must have been with me and my resistances, you know. And also near the end when my father left her and she had nothing after the Islamic Revolution, she was just an old woman who all of a sudden didn't even have her husband anymore. I empathized with her and I understood her loneliness in a way, unfortunately, that I never did. I mean, I had that glimmer of empathy, but our relationship became so sharp that I could not actualize that glimmer.
You're listening to an interview with Azar Nafisi, whose latest book is a memoir, Things I've Been Silent About. How much did she participate in those sessions that you discuss in reading Lolita in Tehran? Was she just out of the room occasionally bringing in coffee, or was she there?
That group, that was such an experience. The group of girls in Reading Lolita in Tehran, we gradually got into the habit of bringing lunch, having, you know, elaborate luncheons where everybody would bring, you know, the food they made. And in those luncheons, my family also participated, and my mother would come. But no, because that class was supposed to be serious, a class. And her intrusions knew no boundaries. So she would open the door from, you know, 55 times, do you want coffee? You know.
Well, it sounds as if that you got your love of literature primarily from your father, not your mother. And you were absorbed by not only Ferdowsi, but also
Farouk Farrokhzad, the feminist Persian poet.
You also discuss a writer, an American writer, who I had not heard of, named Mike Gold.
Yes, Mike Gold. Well, you know that he was the most famous or notorious, depending on the viewpoint, journalist of in 1930s. He was the editor of the left-wing magazine Masses and the New Masses. And he was so powerful that he called Hemingway a blue-collar worker and Thornton Wilder the Emily Post of culture. And they say that Hemingway got so mad that he came into his office and Gold was not there, and he told his secretary, tell Mike to go and, you know.
What's weird is I've been doing these interviews for over 25 years. I've never heard of him.
We should hear of him. I mean, that is one thing memoir reminds us of, that we should not forget our history, because that's who we are. And if we forget that conversation with the past, if our kids today don't know what happened in 1930s, how much can they cope with today? That is a question.
Azar Nafisi, things changed after the Islamic Revolution. And even though today, and I know you've discussed this elsewhere, people talk about the horrors of Savak, the secret police under the Shah, I don't get the sense, even though things were tight, that you had the kind of casual murder that you wound up with under the Islamic Revolution.
No, you're very right, and that is why people should always be careful about not just whom they don't want, but who they want. And that is why in revolutions like this Russian Revolution at the beginning of last century, people got what they did not bargain for, partly because when you become too polarized and too ideological and blind, the person who replaces what you call a dictatorship is not necessarily the best. My own cousins, I had a cousin who was in Shah's jail for 2 years. He belonged to a militant Islamic organization. In under an Islamic regime, this Orthodox Muslim was murdered along with his wife. Another cousin who is now in exile, his wife was murdered. And you talk to Iranians, I like the word you used, casual murder. It is terrible what that concept does to a society.
You were in Iran at the time of when they issued the fatwa.
Against Rushdie, yes.
Yeah, I mean, as a university professor in literature, and I'm sure as someone who by that point had probably even read Satanic Verses, how did you feel, and what was the feeling of your colleagues? Were you even able to speak about it?
Well, I just wanted to tell you, I don't know if your listeners know this, that before Satanic Verses, Rushdie was one of the most beloved and popular writers, and actually Shame got the highest prize that the government gave. Satanic Verses was, the fatwa against it was completely a political ploy. They had not read it. In one sense, it is the ultimate sin, to not only murder people physically, but to try to delete them, even through their imagination. The fact that so many of us in Iran had to see this and not say anything, not to express our empathy for Rushdie, was very painful.
Was it just somebody mentioned it to you and your jaw just dropped? Was it that kind of?
They always start with sort of rumblings, you know, demonstrations here and there, and then prepare for the big thing. But I never in my wildest dreams thought that there would be a death sentence for a citizen of another country who has committed no violence. It had nothing to do with him. His sin was the fact that he was a genuine novelist, because the most interesting thing about Salman Rushdie, each novelist have their own interesting aspects, is that he is just an absolutely playful and boisterous writer. He can't help it. And that is what makes him so absolutely interesting. And playfulness is one of the most heretical things to a tyrannical mindset. In literature, the only thing that is sacred is the profane. So I can imagine what happened.
You talk a lot about things that you were reading. How big was the proscribed list? Is that list in Iran today? And how hard is it to read most literature?
Well, you know, these lists keep changing, because one of the most important things about regimes like that is the fact that they're arbitrary. You know, on one hand, they would censor Desdemona out of the movie Othello, most of Desdemona's scenes. And on the other hand, you can buy Othello in a bookstore, you know, so you never know. Some books like Lolita, of course, are just proscribed, but they keep becoming a little bit more liberal and then again closed. Like, for example, recently there was this report that even books like Da Vinci Code and The Girl with Pearl Earrings, for some reason, were banned. You go figure. I mean, and some of the best, of course, poets and writers, 1001 Nights came out for a while and it was banned, and some of the best poets from Iran.
When books get banned, is there suddenly more interest in
them? Yes. There is more interest, and that is why, like Eastern Europe, people in Iran are so well informed. Because you cannot close down media and internet. This is the good side of internet. I have a lot of grievances, but this, because you can, people know, and people go to great risks. When I was in Iran, I was much better informed about the new Oscars and the latest books than I am here. So that tells you a lot.
You can't go back now, though.
Well, as a friend said, everybody is free to go to Iran. Whether you can leave it is another matter. And to tell you the truth, I don't know. I know that I'm banned. I know that they have written nasty things about me, but they have written it about so many people.
The internet, how blocked off is it? How easy is it to get to read whatever you want?
Well, they keep blocking, and people are so inventive. They keep finding ways of de-blocking. But it was over a year and a half ago, I think, that they arrested some of the bloggers and tortured them, and one of them got 14 years. So you can tell how big that is. The website Goodread was telling me that they have 90,000 Iranians on their website. I don't think, like China, they cannot manage, much more advanced than China in terms of internet.
So it's very possible that things I've been silent about has already been translated and is circulating in Iran.
Well, one young man who had come from Iran about 2 years ago told me that the first time he read Reading Lolita in Tehran was actually in a reading group belonging to one of the Muslim student associations. And anything is possible. Of course, he said the translation was terrible and it was mutilated, but it was still translated.
I was told, it's really funny, and I didn't know what to make of it, but an Iranian told me after the U.S. invaded Iraq, that the U.S. had invaded the wrong country, that had the U.S. invaded Iran, it's possible you would have had people throwing flowers at the soldiers. Now, I found that to be a little bit bizarre, but how true would that have been?
You know, people in Iran have different views on this. Some believe that, some believe the opposite. But I just don't think invasion does it for democracy. You know,
yeah.
We don't want to replace regimes. You mentioned about the Shah. The Shah goes, something far worse came. We don't want to change regimes only. We want to change mindsets, which would be the best guarantee that the next regime will be better than this one. Some people are desperate, and they say, let this go. I fundamentally disagree with the idea, both Iraq and Iran, to tell you the truth.
Then let's look at Iran today. Where is Iran in terms of the continuum that you show in Things I've Been Silent About?
You know, on one hand, obviously the Islamic regime, since I've written either of these books, has become more and more repressive with Mr. Ahmadinejad and his so-called rule. But the interesting thing, what you don't hear in what is now called mainstream media, is the fact that the Iranian people for 30 years have refused to legitimize this regime by accepting it. You have these young Iranian women who have had this campaign called 1 Million Women campaign, where they are gathering signatures against the repressive laws. They keep being jailed, going to jail, coming back, continuing it. Former revolutionaries like Akbar Ganji are now talking about Hannah Arendt and Spinoza and secularism. Students in Iran are far more critical of Mr. Ahmadinejad and tell him to his face than the elite in New York. So my hope lies in the fact that for 30 years we paid a high price, but we learned about individual freedoms with our flesh and blood. And that is where my hope lies.
Is there a possibility that what will happen in Iran is kind of what happened in Romania and even to a lesser degree in the United States, where suddenly, not quite suddenly, but suddenly the power of the right wing just vanished? And of course, in Romania, one day there was Ceausescu, the next day there was democracy.
Well, one of the things that people don't realize, and I said that at the beginning of Mr. Ahmadinejad's presidency, that those who use violence are most vulnerable. Because you don't have staying power when you just delete. You have staying power when you are confident of yourself and you don't need to delete others in order to survive. And what you said about these examples is well true of Iran. And Ahmadinejad, in a speech about universities, said that from the beginning of last century, secularism and liberalism had dominated our universities and we still have not been able to do anything about it. So there you are. We don't understand the vulnerability of violence. Alice Sebold actually is a good example of how you name your rapist and you conquer him.
You have a comment inside the book when you're talking about leaving Iran. Living in the Islamic Republic is like having sex with a man you loathe.
That, of course, now that you have read things I have been silent about, you know that one of the things I feel most ashamed of is marrying someone whom I really didn't love. You are the victim, but you feel dirty because you have to change according to what the regime tells you. And it's not that, you know, I'm a non-Muslim, I'm anti-religion. I'm anti-state-imposing religion. So when the state tells me how to walk, how to talk, what to teach, how to eat, whom to love, whom not to love, and when I'm forced to do these partially in order to survive, I hate myself and I hate those who impose it on me. And I felt a little dirty. Being forced to do what I don't like to.
Later this week, I'm doing an interview with a writer named Nora Vincent, who, as a literary experiment, a journalistic experiment, got herself locked up in three mental institutions.
Phew.
At the end of the first one, she said that trying to maintain your sanity, trying to maintain your sense of individualism inside an institution where the rules are so rigid and your freedom is taken away to you, of course, it's all counterproductive.
That is exactly the point. And that is also why, under such circumstances, unlike what people think, you know, they sometimes think that I'm very political, but I'm not political in terms of political agendas or liking to belong to any group, even the ones I like, you know. But these things are existential. If the state interferes in every single thing that you do, the only way you keep your dignity, as Vaclav Havel said, is to be more yourself. Because at the core of it is the preservation of what makes you unique as an individual. That is why I took refuge in narrative, in stories.
And that's why you took refuge in stories against your mother, too.
That became, I guess, each of us find a way of both coping for life with life and changing life. From early childhood, and I owe this to my father, that was the way where I created spaces. When she scolded me, when she would read my letters and then interrogate me, my mind would go somewhere else. I would be, I don't know, talking to Elizabeth Bennet or Rudabe in Ferdowsi. And then by and by I learned that not only can I read these books and go somewhere and come back, I can write reality from my own perspective and gain control over it.
Your father, Ahmad Nafisi, who was the mayor of Tehran and was thrown in prison, there's a comment where he makes where he says the freest he ever felt was when he was in prison. And I wonder if that's the same dynamic.
P- partly he was saying that because of his relationship with my mother, where that was his weakest spot, not in the public arena. He was very courageous. He couldn't handle the relationship with my mother, where his girl. And in a sense, the jail, because you see, when you are facing an obstacle, when you're facing a difficulty, all your senses become sharp, and your senses for survival become sharp. He learned languages in jail. He started to paint. He would not be able to exercise, but he lost a lot of weight by walking miles around his room, you know. So I guess that made him feel good about himself, although he was in jail.
And now the book has come out and your brother Mohammed has read it. How does he feel about the book?
Mohammed and I are very close, but I don't talk about him more. I could have. Partly is to respect him, because if anyone else in the world can claim this story, it's Mohammed. And I didn't want him to be too much a participant in this. He was very, very generous. He sent me all the diaries and memoirs that I didn't have, the photographs. He worried about me, and he refused to. He only read about 100 pages, and then he refused to read or comment because he didn't want to interfere. God knows how he feels about it. He's not about to tell me, I don't think.
How about writing in English? How difficult was that for you?
I enjoy writing in English. Part of it is because from early childhood I was working both with English and Persian. But, you know, it's like being both Iranian and American at the same time. You look at a language through the alternative eyes of another language, and it opens out all sorts of possibilities. And I love it. I play with English, and I like to both change it and adapt to it.
Well, can you see yourself working on a translation of these books into Farsi?
Yes, which is the most difficult challenge, because it's, again, like first love. You so much wanted to be perfect in the eyes of that first love when you were a kid. And Wudmi Farsi has both those pitfalls. I don't feel as free with it. I don't allow myself to play too many games.
Well, one thing I found, and I suspect it may be one of the reasons why Nabokov is such a great writer, but other fine writers who use English as a second language, there's a certain freedom they have that those of us who know English don't have, because their brain is making different connections between words. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think that this is very close to writing fiction or writing stories, because whenever you write something, you have to write about it through the eyes of a stranger. And you have to write about something that is both very familiar and very strange. And I think maybe for Nabokov or Conrad or others, but on a much lesser level. For me as well, writing in English gives me that freedom, because I'm looking at it through the alternative eyes of Persian, and I also feel freer in it.
Well, what happens when you hit on a concept where there's a Farsi word,
yes,
but there's nothing
I
in English.
I know. And in this book, my son said, Mom, you write, because, you know, a lot of times people in Iran address themselves in terms of endearment, like John, they call him, Azarjan or Khan. And he said, the way you use Babai, which was my father's, they called him Babai. He said, the way you use his name, people think his name is Ahmad Khan, but his name is Ahmad and not Ahmad Khan. Khan was, it means Mr. And I had to use that. That is why my publisher wanted to have a glossary and things like that. Sometimes it's impossible. That is why Persian becomes so impossible to translate, because the best poetry in Persian, like Rumi, is nothing like what you read in translation. Rumi is pure music. It is ecstasy at its highest level, and it's impossible to translate.
Azar Nafisi, you have apparently, you're working on a book on the relationship of culture and politics,
yeah,
and you're also working on a translation of your Nabokov book?
Oh, yeah. One of my former editors at Random House, who's now at Yale University, Eileen Smith, she suggested it. I thought, well, it would be good to revisit him, Nabokov, in this other world that I'm living in now.
Well, are you going to bring it up to date in terms of relationship between the cultures now?
Yes, and I was hoping to write a very, a rather long introduction to, because a lot of people tell me, oh yes, you know, you were living in a repressive culture, so Lolita was important to that culture, but we don't need it. Well, you know, I was going to ask our new president, who's going to bail out imagination and thought in this country? And how far are we going to go if we don't have it? So I think this is a good time to bring up Nabokov.
When you were talking about changing ideas, changing people, even before regime change, I keep thinking about something Obama has kind of hinted at, which is that given that the mainstream is so far to the right here, it's more important to change the laws slowly, but to change the mindset, which is much more difficult.
The only way you can change anything is to change the mindset. This country, since I came here, I returned to U.S. in 1997, has become more and more polarized, sensationalist, and politicized. And to change that around, to make it a culture that pauses, that reflects, that becomes not just questioning the leaders, but questioning the self. That is the real challenge, and that is where I hope he will succeed. That is why I think when he talks about Lincoln and Martin Luther King, we should remember that those men had the most poetic of visions, evoking Shakespeare and Bible. I mean, you know. So it is not that easy, but the Constitution has the first words, we the people, and that is where I would like to work on.
One final question, going from the sublime to the mundane. Has Hollywood expressed any interest in reading Lolita in Tehran?
It has been negotiated for the film. It is very difficult, and I don't want it. One or two scripts I was rather worried about because I don't want it to be Hollywood in the bad sense of the word, because Hollywood has also many good senses. So we are currently again renegotiating. I want this book not to be a trendy book, and it's a very difficult thing to do.
Writing books changes people, and watching them get published changes people. How do you think both writing and publishing the first book changed you, and then how much do you think the second book did?
Writing both books, but especially the second book. The second book has been the hardest, most painful thing I've ever done in my life, and most unexpected. I didn't expect myself to go there. Writing is like giving birth to a child. You go through so much labor, doubt, and pain, and then the book comes into the world, and you don't know where it goes and where it takes you. It has changed me in the sense that I feel good about the fact that somewhere I had the courage to write about myself. I'm not a courageous person, but I had that courage to write and expose myself and not be afraid of it, you know. And the second thing, it has connected me to people I want to be connected to. And it's not the elite necessarily. There is a community of readers who are there. I call them intimate strangers, who connect because they share something that is very Alice in Wonderlandish, and that makes me happy.
You've been listening to an interview with Azar Nafisi, whose latest book is Things I've Been Silent About, Memories. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.